Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every morning from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm well this morning. I was reading something in the newspaper, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it before the show. I'm curious to what you feel about the Star Ledger. The Jersey Star Ledger has reported on e-accounts at schools where parents, and not having kids, I wouldn't know any of this, but there's no more bringing your lunch money to school. Your parents start an account where you punch in a code when you get into school, and your parents have put in enough for you to get school lunches that week.
I think it's great. I think that being able to not have to worry about whether your kid carrying money or whatever, that there's just an account where your kids can their lunch would be great.
I frankly think being a former bully, that would upset you. Because what do you do? Steal a kid's pencils?
Hey, kid, give me some of your credit.
I can just see like the robbery now where you force a kid up to the machine and they can
punch kid, swipe your card.
Exactly. One of the many advantages that comes from this is kids in the school lunch program who are having subsidized lunches now blend in more easily. They don't have to have lunch tickets, mm-hmm. So there's a little less stigmatization if there was any.
Can I tell you something? In school, yeah. I didn't know who the kids were who were on the program.
You were in a wealthy town. There weren't none.
It wasn't that wealthy. There were definitely kids that were getting.
Yeah, I didn't either. I just didn't pay attention.
I didn't pay attention. I didn't know who they were. I didn't care. You're 8 years old. Who cares?
Right. Well, in any event, but the other thing is, it's allowing parents now, many of these systems that are going, like 60% of the school systems in the country have them, and more are going to them, it allows parents, because the receipt comes to you online, mm-hmm. to see what your kids are eating.
Well, you can go log on any time.
Uh-huh.
You can go, you forget the receipt online, you can just go log on at 1:12 and see where your kid ate at 12:50.
Well,
call him on his cell phone and say, hey, put those M&Ms down.
Well, the other thing that, now, of course, you don't know what they got in the vending machine, but they have to have money for that. But, they can't use their lunch money to buy, M&Ms, which was what I did. Of course.
Right.
And Twinkies, that's what I had for lunch. Of course, the school lunch food was disgusting, and
yes.
I'm sure that still is. But, The interesting thing that this also allows parents to do now is they're giving them a greater level of control. You can program in what your kid's not allowed to have.
You're allowed to program in what your kid can have and can't have. Not only that, you can then monitor what they actually purchase and take a look at your kid and look at every single little detail of everything they ate at school.
But you can also set up your preferences as a parent where it's like, okay, one snack a week or one snack a day.
Right.
Or no...
Right, sorry, you had your snack this week. No snack, put it back.
They also program allergies into it. So, I mean, this sounds like a very useful system.
I don't know, it's a little big brothery. Come on. Come on.
Okay. They're 10. It's not big brother, it's father. And father, or mother, knows... it's funny, they had said there were some accusations of being a little big brotherish. Okay, it's better than big brotherish. You're my kid, and...
I'll tell you, honestly, I mentioned this to Jennifer this morning, because we emailed this article to each other. I mentioned this article to Jennifer, she's like, oh yeah, I love it, great idea. Can't wait to use it.
Here's what one of the guys involved in the system says. He says, it's not being big brother... with you keeping an eye on things, what it should do is prompt a parent-child discussion on healthy eating. Yeah, mine would go something like this. You can't have the Twinkies, have an apple. And if you got anything to say about it, tell me on your 18th birthday.
Let me help you. And if you were the kid, you'd be like, what do you mean I can't have an apple? Let me tell you about why I should have a Twinkie, and there are 17 reasons why I should have a Twinkie. And you would badger your mother until she gave in.
Here's actually along those lines here in the end of the Star Ledger, they end the article with a quote from, I
love this quote. I was just about to read the same one.
From Tony Perella, 14. I understand why they want to stop obesity, but come on, it's stupid. We should be able to eat whatever we want. Tony, come see me in 4 years.
Tony, you're 14. Quit it. Sorry. I'm trying to stand up for you, Tony, but quit it.
Okay, we're going to move on from children to other small animals. We're going to talk about rats.
I just gave Francis a dirty look for those of you not in the
studio. No, we're going to talk about rats. It turns out there's a study done that shows that rats prefer organic food generally. Everything from all the way down to biscuits made with organic wheat. Humans have trouble ranking the difference if there are no other flavors sometimes, but rats seem prefer organic food by a lot, and scientists are trying to figure out why.
Well, that rats have a keener sense of smell than we.
Well, and rats also have a very direct line between, you know, our sense of taste is not attuned to our environment. We still crave salt and sugar and fat when we have too much of it, you know. But rats have a keen sense of what they need to survive and what is the more healthy food for them to eat because, well, they, you know, are still in a very primal state.
They certainly know what will kill them and what won't kill them. Okay, they're definitely paying attention to those.
We're not saying that non-organically raised foods are likely to kill you, but what they have found is that in organic food there are more phytochemicals and antioxidants, and they think this may be because organic food is under threat more and exists in an environment that's not as sterile. And these phytochemicals that wind up being antioxidants and often wind up being flavonoids are a response to keeping the plant alive. And so when a plant feels threatened, it produces more of them. If a plant's in a sterile environment where there are no pathogens at all, it doesn't work as hard to preserve itself, and you get lower concentrations of these things.
Basically, what Francis is saying, I'll translate that to English for you, is we like the smell of basil, and bugs don't like the smell of basil. So if your basil's more pungent, it's more likely to keep the bugs away.
And if the basil thinks that it's under threat, is out in a normal environment where there are normal pathogens, it will work hard to be pungent. Whereas if it's sort of grown in a sterile environment where we've used synthetic chemicals and killed all the wheat around it,
it doesn't have to put energy into that.
It doesn't have to do that. One of the things that's interesting that's come out from this is scientists have found that what triggers the response in plants is the chemical signature of a substance called chitin, along with other things as well. Chitin exists in bugs, exoskeletons, and in the cell walls of fungi. And in the presence of chitin, the plant responds by creating more of these phytochemicals and much more flavor. So you can have up to 50% more flavor. What they found is if they take chitin derived from waste products of crabs and
lobster shells and crab shells, these are the same types. Like Francis said, they're found in these fungus that attack these plants, but they're also found in lobster shells and crab shells and things
same
like that.
Same exoskeleton as a bug.
So what they did was they took them from the exoskeletons from the lobsters.
They make chitosan from this stuff, and when you expose these plants to chitosan, you get 50% more flavor from your plants. And so, chitosan is available as a dietary supplement. It's supposed to encourage you to lose weight. But according to professors who did this study, if you buy that diet substance, the chitosan, it should work as well as the lab-grade chemicals.
And basically what they're doing is they're soaking the leaves of the plant in the stuff
and
soaking
roots.
The roots in the plant of the plant. Whenever they transfer pots, they soak the roots. And basically what's going on is the plants are becoming more flavorful.
And what they're saying is they would encourage master gardeners to try them for fresher aromas and see what happens. They want to see it out in the field. Can't hurt. It's called chitosan. You can buy it. It's a dietary supplement.
Well, especially when you talk about what we're doing to... We're not talking about, you know, injecting some gene at the cellular level to change the genetic structure of the basil.
And we're not talking about putting a chemical on it that, you know, kills things. We're talking about throwing lobster shells
putting lobster shells on your plants. You know, seems like a pretty good way to go in order to stress these plants, just like we stress grapes to get the best grapes, stress these plants to get get more interesting, flavorful basil and herbs.
I think often people assume that people who are pro-organic agriculture and pro-low-input agriculture like we are against innovation. And we're not. This is a great innovation.
Absolutely.
Hey, listen, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk with Andrew Knowlton about Iron Chef, everybody's favorite TV reality show having to do with cooking. Back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. Time is 11:16.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Today, we're welcoming Andrew Knowlton. Andrew Knowlton is an editor at Bon Appetit magazine, and he's also a judge on the next Iron Chef.
Andrew, how are you today? Welcome to the show.
Good. Thanks for the opportunity, guys.
A judge on Iron Chef. Aren't you afraid they're going to come after you with a knife if you say something they don't like?
Well, you know, I didn't think it would be that bad when I heard I was going to do it. But then when you're standing face-to-face with these chefs, it's quite intimidating because, you know...
Because they have knives.
Yes, they have knives. And in our business, you know, you don't get to tell the chef what you think about his food right after you eat it. So it's
yeah, you get to cower and write about it in your blog.
Right, I get to hide behind Bon Appetit.
See, in my business as this restaurant owner, I have to confront the chef all the time when
that's
I don't.
That's right. Yeah, your costs are way over.
yeah, but when somebody writes something bad about me, fortunately, it doesn't happen very often. But if I knew where your office was, I would come to you.
So tell us a little bit about the history of Iron Chef and how this became such a cult craze in the United States.
Well, you know, most of us started watching it on Food Network when it was the original Iron Chef from Fuji Television in Japan. And, you know, it was perfect timing. It was when people started focusing on ingredients and the quality of the ingredients. And, you know, I remember watching, like, a live octopus battle. And, you know, most people don't even see live animals in the U.S. that much anymore. That's mm-hmm. changing. But, you know, they had live langoustine and live octopus. And, you know, as the whole celebrity chef thing caught on, and when they launched it in the U.S., you know, it just kind of took off, and it's been this amazing success. And, you know, they have four Iron Chefs right now, Mario Batali, Bobby Flay, Kat Cora, and Masahiro Morimoto. And they decided, you know what, let's get another Iron Chef, somebody who's equally as dynamic. So that's kind of what happened with the next Iron Chef, which is this new show that starts on Sunday at 9 o'clock on Food Network.
I want to talk about the next Iron Chef, and the nice thing about the Restaurant Guys Radio Show is we have a long time to really flesh things out. I think, however, that let's talk about a little bit more about where it came from. I think I always thought it was fascinating that Americans watched Iron Chef and became so fascinated with Iron Chef. It's the concept of the show that's very rich, because people got enamored of this when they were watching it on Japanese television, translated mm-hmm. with subtitles.
And they didn't even really know who the chefs
and,
were.
You know, and they weren't familiar with the cuisine and didn't know who the chefs were, yet it was still, you know, popular with American audiences. What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, again, I think it's going behind the scenes and seeing it's not this kind of calm, quiet, very serene cooking show. You know, there's stuff flying all over the place. There's a live fish. And the common person doesn't get to see that often. I mean, you guys know a kitchen is probably one of the more crazy work environments that you'll ever see. And it gave people a glimpse of that. I mean, I also like the dubbing that was involved in some of those. I mean, some of the giggles that the judges would have.
They definitely made a little campy on purpose.
They did, which is brilliant. I mean, it worked. I just, you know, it's, for me, it was just seeing the process from taking an ingredient and creating this amazing meal on the fly, and then have people judging it and there be a winner. I mean, cooking is competitive by nature, but when you actually have a contest, I don't know, it really sucked me in.
You know, you just to allude to something you said before about a lot of people don't know the actual nature of a kitchen. I love being in the kitchen. I love being in the dining room when I'm working. But Mark and I, we have a lot of friends who will go out to nice restaurants across the country, and people will sometimes book us at the chef's table in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And I love being close to those great chefs and all, but I always think, oh, God, can't we eat in the dining room? I don't. It's so nice out there with the tables. I don't want to be eating next to it. But I can see the fascination, if you're not in it every day, of wanting to see exactly how that all works.
Yeah, I mean, I always try to tell people, I mean, I worked in a few kitchens here and there, but you never know what that rush is like. You don't realize taking all these ingredients, and when you've got a dining room of, you know, 80, you know, people who are all, you know, self-proclaimed experts ready to judge your food, And you've been standing already for 8 hours, you know, sweating and people yelling at you and cursing at you. Well, I guess that's the way it used to be, but hopefully we've matured a little bit more. But you
except
know,
for Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, it's an amazing process, an amazing place, and you know, cooking now with all the TV shows and it's a way of life for people. It's kind of we like to say it's a cultural signifier. It's a way to enter into a society and to find out about the place. And food is a lifestyle now. It's not just something that you eat at the dinner table. It's everywhere.
Well, we'll be back in just a moment talking more with Associate Editor Andrew Knowlton of Bon Appetit magazine, who's a judge on The Next Iron Chef, which is a new show that starts this Sunday. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And you can find out more about it in just a moment. WCTC 1450, the time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we're speaking with Andrew Knowlton about his role as a judge on the show that starts this Sunday, The Next Iron Chef. So, The Next Iron Chef, Andrew, is about not unknowns like in some of the talk shows, and
right,
not people who are quite yet at the first tier celebrity level. These are 8 accomplished chefs,
right,
who haven't quite made it to that top tier yet.
But really accomplished chefs. I mean, we're talking about some of the most serious chefs in the country, but who don't have maybe some of the exposure that some of the other chefs have.
Right. I mean, these are, as we say, this is not amateur hour. Nobody is learning how to cook on the job. I mean, they're all professionals. They all, most of them own their own restaurants, which you guys know is different than being a chef.
Fools.
You know. and, it, you know, as opposed to, you know, when you talk about celebrity chefs, there's probably, you know, I don't know, 10 that people who aren't even into food kind of know. So this is definitely that top tier of chefs. I mean,
four of these people, and not to plug another publication here, but 4 of these people have been in Food and Wine magazine's up and comers over the last 10 years. Four of the 8.
Well, and beyond that, I mean, these people have been cooking, and they're not just new. They're within the business. Everyone knows who these people are. So Tracy Desjardins is owner of Jardiniere in San Francisco. I remember reading about her and going to San Francisco to have her food when she was the first executive chef at Drew Neaport's restaurant out there, Rubicon.
Yeah.
So, and that was, what, 12, 14 years ago?
Yeah, that's
so this woman is an accomplished chef. So I think this really is very exciting to me because these are our top people who are not. I think it speaks to the power of television as well that, okay, we all understand that with American Idol, that if you take somebody who's nobody, you know,
right,
you're the assistant sous chef at some restaurant, and you, in front of a national audience, rise to the top under the tutelage of Tom Colicchio and Hubert Keller, you know, that really changes your life. But to have 8 top chefs who own their own restaurants and are successful look upon this as, you know, television having such an impact in one show to become Iron Chef, do you think it's going to have as much of an impact on their careers?
I think it's going to, I mean, it's going to change every single one of them. And, you know, when the winner is announced, I mean, that person is going to be thrust into the national spotlight. You know, I think the reason that, you know, I agreed to do this and they did, the 8 contestants, is, you know, calling this a reality show is not correct. I mean, sometimes, because then you think, oh, we're going to show them, you know, all sleeping together and smoking and doing all this kind of stuff. This show is about cooking, and I think the chefs really wanted their skills to be presented. You're going to see knife skills. You're going to see how people kind of formulate an idea about what makes a dish, about layering flavors, about texture. And I think, you know, a lot of cooking shows don't do that. It's just kind of, you know, while this is entertainment, hopefully people will get out, you know, kind of the mindset of a chef. And I think that was important to these eight guys and gals, because like you said, they're already at the top of their class. Mm-hmm. So what, you know, they're not trying to win their own kitchen, so to speak.
You know, Andrew, we're going to break for the news in just a moment, but when we come back, I really want you to talk about some of the behind-the-scenes stuff that goes on at Iron Chef.
1450 WCTC time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today, our guest is Andrew Knowlton. Andrew is an editor of Bon Appetit magazine, but he's also a judge on the next Iron Chef, which begins this Sunday. Andrew, one of the things we were talking about with the next Iron Chef, this is taking eight top-tier chefs who are really at the top of the game, running top restaurants in the country, and putting them into that, you know, hopefully at the end of Top Chef, we'll elevate them to that celebrity chef status, putting them in a national spotlight where more than just the foodies know about them.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that I'm really interested in this show is to find people who run a business every day, who've found their culinary identity, who are engaged in the ongoing concern of running a business. You know, on the top level of chefs, there was an article in the Times just last Wednesday about how, you know, that top level of chefs with restaurants everywhere and television shows and celebrity book signings, there's not a lot of time left to cook behind the range, you know. These guys are, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong.
But I heard a celebrity chef say last night, like, I couldn't believe that he said this. He said, yeah, I got so many restaurants I can't remember which the names of all of them.
I know who you're talking about.
And I thought, you should know the names of all of your restaurants.
Or you should never admit that on television. But I would say that this is the top level of chefs that is still cooking in their kitchen every night.
Yeah, it's, you know, to be honest, it's quite, you know, with the celebrity chefdom, it's controversial about, you know, there's a lot of criticism about you're not in the kitchen cooking. And you know, I referred to it earlier, and you guys know how hard it is to cook. I mean, but I think what people have to realize, and I remind myself of this all the time, is, you know, these guys and gals had spent, you know, however long, you know, peeling potatoes and carrots and standing on their feet for, you know, 18 hours a day for a long time. So to expect somebody, once they reach a certain level, it's just like being a boss of, you know, a company, that they're there all the time and that they have to be, you know, sautéing onions or else it's not their food, I don't think that's very fair, and it's not really practical.
Well,
you should know the name of all your restaurants.
I think, and I'm just going to say this, and I'm not going to say the restaurants that I think don't accomplish this well, but there are, we all know, certainly in the industry, there are some people who are celebrity chefs, and I'll give Mario Batali as a person who I have a huge amount of respect mm-hmm. for, because I go to his restaurants and almost always I'm
spot
impressed
on
by what happens at each of his restaurants.
Absolutely.
But some of the people who are celebrity chefs who own these giant empires, that's not always the case.
Yeah, and I think what you talk about, I don't want to, you know, praise Mario too much, because I think he probably knows he's pretty good already.
and he's not afraid to tell you.
No. But see, I feel like I always tell a lot of my colleagues that I say, have you ever had Mario Batali's cooking? And a lot of them are like, I probably haven't. I've been to his restaurants,
mm-hmm.
but has he actually cooked? I'm like, he cooked for me on Iron Chef. So,
well, you know,
if you went to Poe in like 1992,
yes.
you
Which we did, thank heaven. Well, but you know, here's the deal. Actually, in the spirit of full disclosure, Mario went to college here in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We crossed over for a year at the very end, Mark and me and Mario, when he was cooking at Stuff Your Face Bistro here on Easton Avenue. The food wasn't as good then.
But I think what we're really talking about and why Mario and I think some of the other Sobeys chefs who own multiple restaurants are successful is they are restaurateurs. They're business people, and they hire people to run their restaurants who they, you know, would leave to watch their kids, you know. And they know how to cook. I mean, I know most of the chefs at Mario's restaurants by name because they are amazing in their own right, and he lets them do what they want to do, and they have a sense of ownership. Once you just start opening up restaurants left and right, and it just becomes a business, and the people who you employ don't have
a vested interest.
Yeah, then it's going to show in the food, and that's really what it comes down to. And a lot of people criticize the whole, you know, opening 10 restaurants, but I view it as the more restaurants there are that, you know, are kind of carrying the local and artisanal and showing people what good food is, that it's not, you know, what you guys were talking about before, that it's some of it's organic or that it's not processed or it's fresh and made from scratch. I'm all for that gospel, you know. Let's get that more out there, and, you know, some of the chains that's not food, you know.
Hey, Andrew, I would open 10 restaurants if I weren't swamped with two.
Yeah, I just can't figure it out. Mark and I agree with you 100%. Is you know, there's that old adage that, you know, when you start at a job, you're paid for what you do.
That's right.
And 99% of what you do and 1% of what you know. And then when you're at the top of the food chain, you're paid for 99% of what you know and 1% of what you do. But what you know is, you know, that's the hard thing to master. And I think when a chef really does take, like Mario or Thomas Keller with his, you know, admittedly few number of restaurants comparatively, you know, they take their imprimatur and they put it on a restaurant and they make it top quality and they succeed, that is the role of an executive chef.
That's right.
It used to be they'd say, oh, don't go to that restaurant on Mondays, it's the chef's day off. Well, that's not a successful chef. He's a successful cook Tuesday through Sunday, but he's not a successful chef because on Monday when he's not there, it's not very good.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times by the time, and I'm not, there still are a lot of chefs that are on the line every night, but, you know, that's not the job. You can't watch the front of the house and the back of the house if you're on the line every night. You might be expediting, which, you know, by expediting, you know, sending out the dishes and making sure. And that's enough. I mean, I don't know. That's enough for me. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
I agree.
Yeah.
Hey, let's turn our attention to the show that's coming up, which everyone is going to learn. Go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll tell you where you can find the next Top Chef.
The next Iron Chef.
The next Iron Chef. Sorry. Wow. the next Iron Chef. What are the types of challenges that these folks are given over the course of the season? How are they winnowed down to select the next Iron Chef?
Well, You mentioned another show before there by accident, but
yeah.
The difference between that show and this show is obviously the talent level, but it does follow the same thing. Each show, there's 6 episodes, and each episode, one of the chefs is eliminated. So they're put through various stages of, speed and, simplicity and innovation and resourcefulness. There's an amazing one that takes place, I can't give too much away, but it is abroad in Munich and then Paris. Some amazing task, and you really see these people. I mean, they have no idea what is going to be thrown at them, and to see them kind of, their faces drop, and then, all right, I have to get my you-know-what together and cook a good meal. It's pretty amazing, and, you know, we weren't allowed to talk to them or hang out with them at all, you know.
I think that's a good thing.
Oh, it was an amazing thing because, you know, we wanted to be honest about what we were doing. But like I said, I've eaten at most of these guys and gals' restaurants before, and, you know, I've interviewed a few of them. I'm not friendly with any of them necessarily. But, you know, when you're sitting there taking a bite of somebody's food and, like I said, judging them and then saying, you know what, your food wasn't good enough, It's intimidating, but I will say that in the show, we had maybe one or two dishes that I wouldn't have ordered at a restaurant, but everything else was so solid and, you know, so expertly presented. You know, the funny thing is, I think the one thing that a lot of people suffer from, and it happens on the regular Iron Chef as well, is it all comes down to seasoning your food properly.
Mm-hmm.
And some people get caught up in the concept or what the ingredient is or, you know, the different flavors. But, man, you guys know, if you don't salt your food.
Or you oversalt it. You do that wrong. It is the most basic part of cooking, and it is the most frequent mistake.
And sometimes you build this entire beautiful thing, and I think, you know, my kingdom for a morsel of salt, you know?
I know.
You just missed the basics. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back more and talk with Andrew Knowlton about the upcoming series, The Next Iron Chef, 1450 WCTC. Time is 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking today with Andrew Knowlton. He's a judge on The Next Iron Chef.
So Andrew, in some of the Iron Chef kind of behind the scenes shows, we've learned that the Iron Chefs have some idea of what the mystery ingredient's gonna be. How did that happen in The Next Iron Chef? What do the contestants know and what do they not know?
Well, you know, they didn't know what the task was until the test was until Alton Brown, who you're familiar with.
That's the guy that my sister keeps telling me has to be on the show, and I keep getting hate mail from people that he's never been on our show. Yeah, I know who he is. But he's got to come on soon. We've already contacted the people over there.
Okay. He's a nice guy.
Good.
A little ornery once in a while. But.
Me too.
they really didn't know that much. I mean, obviously you can't just throw something at somebody, you know, a chef, and not tell them that, you know, they're going to be cooking or something. But, you know, they didn't know that much about the ingredients. They didn't know where we were traveling. They didn't know until they got there kind of who the judges were or, you know, what ingredients they worked with. So it was really, you know, survival of the fittest. Like, you know, there's no planning out a menu for a week with this stuff.
Yeah.
So I think it was, in that sense, it was very different than the normal Iron Chef, just because in the normal Iron Chef, you know, it's just a one-day thing, and I think people can kind of think about what, even though they don't know the ingredients, they can kind of think about, plug in, you know, certain recipes, and whatever the ingredient is, you can almost kind of plug it in there.
Mm-hmm.
But with this, it was, you know, totally up in the air, and it, you know, there was a couple times there, a couple episodes, which, you know, I haven't seen them all, that the judges, Donatella Arpaia, who you guys probably
mm-hmm.
know.
Sure.
And Michael Ruhlman, who's a great food writer.
Michael's been on the show a few times.
Yes. You know, we had some pretty heated discussions about who we thought should go on to the next round. So I think it'll be interesting. Hopefully they, the editors let us have our say. But, you know, again, this is about the chefs and really showing people, you know, bringing cooking into people's homes that normally wouldn't get it, you know, I think is a great thing. Because for somebody, you know, like us, who we love food and want to share that with other people.
Well, now, when I look at the eight contestants here, I see two contestants from San Francisco, but other than that, they're pretty much from around the country.
Yeah.
Was that done on purpose to sort of look regionally around America?
I can't say for sure. I mean, I know that, you know, whenever we try to do stuff for Bon Appetit and, you know, cover restaurants, geographic diversity is important, and a lot of times we take for granted that, you know, everybody's on the East Coast and West Coast, but there's amazing restaurants, especially these days, all throughout the U.S., and I think this list is very, you know, is well represented by that. And the other thing, too, I know a lot of people, I was reading some stuff about there wasn't enough New York chefs, but you also have to remember who the Iron Chefs are right now.
Right, sure.
Mm-hmm. You've got Mario and Morimoto, who has a restaurant here, as well as Philadelphia. And then, you know, you also have Bobby Flay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think that I think the New Jersey coverage of national publications in the restaurant scene should really be up. Actually, I'm sort of half serious about that, because living in the shadow of New York and Philadelphia, it's like, you know, I often say that there are people doing stuff in New Jersey that if they were only in the middle of Nebraska, they'd be like the destination restaurant of the country. But you know, it's people are sort of loathe to look at New Jersey.
No, it's a wonderful destination. I've been to a number of restaurants over there. I don't get over there as often as I should, probably. But, you know, Hoboken, just across the water, has some amazing kind of Latino restaurants. And even down here, I think there's one in Red Bank I've been to a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And amazing restaurants. And it's just, you know, it's something that we pride ourselves in covering, not just New York and San Francisco, but,
right,
you know, the whole country.
Yep.
So the part of this to me that is just amazing, you've gotten these eight great chef owners out of their restaurants and sequestered them so they're not in touch with their restaurants. That would kill me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did they handle that? How did they deal with being away from their restaurants for...
Well, you know, it was a pretty quick process. I mean, we were gone for about 4 or 5 weeks. So I guess that is a long time to be away from your restaurant. But again, it comes back to who's running your restaurant and having faith in those. But, you know, I think they had a good time, the camaraderie between them. And, you know, they're all competitive by nature. They wouldn't be where they are. But they were all very professional, and I think they kind of bonded and realized that, I don't know, I feel like some of them maybe came to the show thinking, not that it was a joke, but that it wouldn't be fierce or real. And I think after that first day, which you'll see in that first episode, there's some crazy ingredients involved, and I'll just say none of these people were pastry chefs, and maybe one of those battles had something to do with pastry. So they all kind of freaked out, because, you know, there's nothing worse than a savory chef trying to do sweets.
Yes, we know.
They have no idea what they're doing.
They're two different skill sets. People just,
yes.
You know, I guess, you know, some of the shows on television have shown that, but they're two distinct different skill sets, and it's a rare person who has both.
Yeah, and you know, when people watch on Sunday, you know, there's a few of the chefs that just freak out, you know. Sugar? I don't know what to do with sugar.
Well, and that's because, I mean, for those in the listening audience, they're usually two different temperaments of people. The savory chef is the guy, you know, slam dancing on the line, everything's coming out quick and fast and hot, and it's done as much by feel as by recipe, and things are adjusted every minute. And the pastry chef, in an ideal world, shows up at 5 o'clock in the morning,
yeah,
in a temperature-controlled kitchen, is very quiet, and everything is measured and precise and exact. And it's just a very different thing. So I look forward to seeing that. I have one final question for you, Andrew. On some of the other reality shows, we see a lot of, well, we see some drama, but we also see a lot of melodrama. Do we have any of that going on?
The ones I've seen, the episodes I've seen, there's no cast typing here. There's no pigeonholing of personalities. There's no evil person, or there's no sex pot. You know, there's none of that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's eight super competitive chefs getting into the kitchen, duking it out, and then having a bunch of so-called experts judge their food and see, you know, which one is the next Iron Chef. And I think it's exciting. I have a question for you guys, though. Are you hedging your bets on any one chef?
I have a bet.
You did?
For sure. For sure. Do you want me to tell you who it is?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Tracy Desjardins is gonna really stand up there. She's been doing this a long time. I've had her food She's big time.
Me too, but I think Jill Davies hot. Anyway, we're going to leave it right there. We'll come back. Thank you so much, Andrew, for being
on the
show.
Thanks a lot.
Watch the next Iron Chef coming up this Sunday on TV. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC time is 1156.
WCTC, Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We were just talking about the next Iron Chef, which I think is going to be great. One of the contestants whose food I've had in a couple of different restaurants, I mentioned it during the show, is Tracy Desjardins.
Mm-hmm.
And her restaurant is Jardiniere in San Francisco. Beautiful restaurant. But the first time I had her food was when I went out to San Francisco when Drew Neaport opened his first San Francisco restaurant.
Rubicon.
Mm-hmm. And I went to the bar there, and I was with a friend who was meeting a woman there for a date. And so I was invited to have drinks and then leave. But while I was having drinks there, I met a friend of mine who also worked for Drew in New York, who evidently the maitre d' had left in a hurry, and so they flew my friend Michael Carlucci,
mm-hmm.
Who was the maitre d' at Marrachet in New York, out to San Francisco in a moment's notice to be
one of the advantages of having multiple restaurants, by the way.
Oh, sure.
Is having multiple maitre d's that you can move from place to place.
Get Carlucci on a plane and send him to San Francisco for 3 weeks while we find somebody new. It turns out that's his first night there. He's starting work the next day. And I was sitting at the bar where I was distinctly invited to not stay past cocktails. And I run into Carlucci, who mm-hmm. came in. It was great maitre d', one of the best maitre d's I've ever seen, who is sitting at the bar. He's just finished orientation. He's going to work the next day. And so he says, "You want to go out? Best night I ever had in San Francisco. Drew Neaport's organization made reservations for us all over town."
Oh, that's great.
And we went to Gary Danko, and we went all over San Francisco. And let me tell you something. I mean, I had some contacts in San Francisco, but going out with the new maitre d' of Rubicon set up by Neaport.
It's a good way to do it, for sure.
That was really a lot of fun, I have to tell you. There's no place to sign up for that. There's no freaking flyer miles going to get you that.
Yeah, I got to visit out there while Michael was out there, too. It's just a great experience. Well, I love Rubicon anyway, and Tracy's food is spectacular.
Well, and now, when you talk about all of these chefs, they've been cooking for many years mm-hmm. in a top level. So they come to it with, you know, these young chefs on Top Chef, it's interesting to see them sort of develop their culinary identity next to the judges like Colicchio and Keller mm-hmm. that have an identity. Here you have guys who are really professionals. This
I mean,
is
remember,
going to be amazing.
And we're harping on Tracy Desjardins, but all these guys have similar pedigrees. Tracy was Food and Wine top, you know, the next chef, Top Chef, in 1995.
I hope you've enjoyed this hour with Restaurant Guys. I hope you tune into the next Top Chef. I'm Francis Schott.
I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.